Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host for today, Megan Cochran, and it is an honor to welcome Michael Gratz back to the New Books Network to talk about his new book, The Power to Destroy: How the Anti-Tax Movement Hijacked America. Michael Gratz is a leading authority on tax politics and policy. He's professor emeritus at both Columbia and Yale Law Schools, served in the U.S. Treasury Department, and among other honors, is a John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Fellow and a Fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He is also an author of many books, most recently, The Wolf at the Door, The Menace of Economic Insecurity and How to Fight It with Ian Shapiro, and The Burger Court and the Rise of the Judicial Right with Linda Greenhouse. In this latest book, The Power to Destroy, you tell the story of the anti-tax movement and how it has gained strength in the United States for the last half century, building support as it moved from the fringes to the mainstream. You have said that this anti-tax movement is the most important overlooked social and political movement of the last half century. You've also said that the movement has impeded the nation's ability to protect its people from the vicissitudes of life, produced massive public debt, and contributed to the country's exceptional inequality. And before we get to all of that, which is a lot, I just want to take a moment to tell you and our listeners how great the book is. There is no doubt that tax policy is an important subject, but our listeners might be forgiven for assuming that a book about taxes could be dry. But I found this to be an exciting story, full of tension, high stakes, and even a bit of dry humor. It's a really great read. I found it absolutely riveting. All the way from when the book starts in the 70s right through to the present, there were times when I was reading it when I felt like I was lurking in the White House or in Congress listening in on people's conversations. So I really appreciate it. Now, let's get to the book. Let's start with you. Why did you decide to write this book now? And what did you mean when you said it's the most important overlooked social and political movement of the last half century?
Well, I decided to write it now because I'd had a conversation actually with my agent in which she had been urging me to write a book about the anti-tax movement. And I said, well, everybody knows that story. It's not a story I need to tell. And she said, well, just go ask people and see what they say. And so I went around, and what I've described to my economics friends as casual empiricism. And I asked people to name the most important social and political movements of the last half century. And they named the women's movement, the civil rights movement, and the LGBTQ movement, and the Christian evangelical movement, and the environmental movement, and then more recently, the MAGA movement. And it will come as no surprise to you, but no one ever mentioned the anti-tax movement. And so I then was convinced that it had been overlooked. I was well aware of its importance. And I set about trying to tell the story of how this happened.
The idea of lower taxes is so attractive for most people that it can sometimes be hard to imagine why it's not always the right answer. Can you start us off really with giving a picture of why this is a danger? What's the danger in the anti-tax? What's the sort of actual risk involved at a high level?
Well, it's a really good question. There are a number of risks, I think. Obviously, the most obvious risk is that if we don't have enough taxes to pay for the health insurance, the retirement security, the national defense, the parks, and the schools, and the fire trucks and the police that we all expect to be there when we need them. We can't count on those things from our government anymore. The United States is in this unique position where once we stopped paying for all of our goods and services that the government provides, we were able to borrow, and not everybody is in that position. And I hope we'll come back to that. But I think one of the risks is that we're now borrowing so much that when interest rates were zero, it looked like it was a pretty sensible thing to do. But now that interest rates are no longer zero and are actually quite high compared to what they were in the recent past, I think the interest on the federal debt is really crowding out a whole series of other expenditures. But the other thing that I want to make sure we talk about is that people view taxes as something apart from the culture, and that it's just an economics story. And as you know from having read the book, a lot of the book is about the efforts of the anti-tax movement to separate us. This is how Howard Jarvis, who started the movement in California, as I describe it, went about separating people. He described the us that pay taxes from the them that don't pay taxes. Ronald Reagan famously did this with his repeated stories of a welfare queen who was a fraudster and had six husbands who didn't exist and was riding, of course, a Cadillac. She had to be riding a Cadillac. And Mitt Romney did it more recently. The listeners will remember that Mitt Romney said that, you know, there were 47% of the people who will never vote for him because they're so dependent on government that they don't pay any income taxes. And so there is this effort to have separated the public, and I have to say, I think it has been quite successful. But in the late 70s, when I date this movement from having started, even though, of course, tax resistance goes back to the Boston Tea Party, but I'm talking about the modern anti-tax movement. The 1970s race was really very central to what was going on in California at that time. And there were lots of racial overtones. And as you know, the next important thing that happens in the 1978 period is that the Christian evangelicals join the anti-tax movement and really formulate an anti-IRS position as an essential element of the anti-tax movement in response to an effort to cut off tax exemptions and deductible contributions for segregation academies, for those schools that were formed mostly in the South in response to the Supreme Court's effort to desegregate schools in America, beginning with a decision in 1954 in Brown v. Board of Education. And that was a time in which the IRS said, if you are a segregated school, you're violating a national policy and you're not entitled to tax exemptions. And you have to show that you really are admitting minority students. And this brought the Christian evangelicals into the Republican coalition. It made them an important and lasting part of the Republican anti-tax and anti-IRS movement. And it was really grounded in the effort to maintain segregated schools and to get public funding for those segregated schools. And the tax exemptions and the tax deductions for charitable gifts to those schools, along with some grants from some states in the South, public grants, were their financial lifeblood. And so they were greatly threatened by that. And that's an important story. And so the basic point that I really want to make is that they're economic risks, and I think they're quite serious now. But they're also very important political and cultural risks.
I want to come back to some of that again later in our discussion, but I want to open up a little bit of what you just discussed. There's this aspect of the Christian evangelicals and the political movements in the South that you were just talking about. There's also another sort of religious aspect to what you write about. And you even have a chapter called The Prophets of the Supply Side Gospel, which I thought was great. And I remember when this sort of magic of anti-tax, lower tax mystery of the supply side gospel, I remember when that was described with a different quasi-religious metaphor as voodoo economics. And I'd love to take a moment to just talk for you to maybe talk about what's going on here. What is it that people really believe? What do they really believe is going on? Is there evidence to support those beliefs? And if not, why do they believe it?
Well, this is a great question, Megan. There's a lot to it. So let's go back to the 1970s for a moment, when the supply side view of economics came into being. And what caused that was the vacuum that was created by the failure of Keynesian economics. And so Keynesian economics had said that you can either have high inflation or you can have high unemployment, but you won't have both, that there are trade-offs that will be made. And in the 1970s, the country began experiencing what became known as stagflation, which was a combination of high unemployment and high inflation. And the government had no solution for this. Jerry Ford, who was president when it really hit the country, urged Americans to wear what he called win buttons, whip inflation now, which his chief economic advisor, Alan Greenspan, who went on to be the head of the Federal Reserve, described as the stupidest idea he had ever heard. But it was clear that we weren't going to solve these problems by wearing buttons. And that created a vacuum, and the vacuum was filled in two ways. One was by supply side economics, in which a whole group of economists, including some Nobel Prize winners at the University of Chicago, basically said, look, what you've got to do is, instead of looking at the demand side and giving consumers more money to spend when the economy is in trouble, which is what Keynesian economics had urged, that you should instead give investors and entrepreneurs money that they can invest and produce a greater supply of goods and services, and that will then stimulate the economy. And that was the prophets of the supply side movement. But one of the prophets of the supply side movement became famous, and that was Arthur Laffer, who was a really obscure business economics professor at the University of Southern California. And there is a story which I have to admit, I don't know whether it's an apocryphal story or whether it's a true story. The participants all insist that it happened. And so I guess I'm going to go along with the fact that it happened. But the story is that Arthur Laffer met with Donald Rumsfeld, who you know was Donald Trump's Secretary of Defense. But at that time, he was working in the Ford administration as chief of staff to the president. And Dick Cheney, who was a deputy of Rumsfeld's, was at the event, and Arthur Laffer sat down and he drew a curve, and the curve shows that if you have a zero rate of tax, you don't collect any income tax because the rate is zero. It's obvious. And at 100%, he argued, you won't collect any tax because no one will work, because if the government's taking all their money, nobody will work. And he therefore said, and there's somewhere that we can reduce taxes and raise revenues. And the idea was that by reducing tax rates, somehow you would produce more revenues for the government. And this is one of the founding myths of the anti-tax movement. That is, we've reduced taxes in 1981. We reduced them again in 2001. We reduced them in 2003. We reduced them in 2017. I could go on. And it's never produced more revenue. It's always cost the government revenue to give a large tax cut.
I mean, what's fascinating about that is it's a curve with no numbers on it. So
exactly.
It's not a curve drawn from historical evidence. It's a theoretical curve that has not been borne out. So why does it perpetuate?
Well, I think when it was first drawn in the 1970s, when tax rates were 70%, there was it was easy to believe that tax rates could be reduced and the economy would grow faster. And more revenue would be generated by economic growth. The problem, of course, is that by the time Ronald Reagan left office, the top tax rate had been reduced from 70% to 28%. And it's never gone above 39.6%, which was what Bill Clinton brought it back to when he was president. And since the Clinton presidency, it sort of ranged between 35 and 39.6%. Well, it's very hard to believe at those rates that this is going to make some huge difference in economic growth. And the rates are low enough at 39.6% that we know high income people are going to work, and they have lots of ways to avoid those taxes at 39.6% by just capital gains, among other things. So it's a proposition that's certainly outlived its time, but Steve Mnuchin, who was Donald Trump's Secretary of the Treasury in 2017, told the Congress that the Trump tax cuts would produce enough revenue to offset the tax cuts, which has not been the case. And so it's one of the founding myths that has been proven false over and over again. The other myth, which I think is important, is a myth that is really attributable to Milton Friedman, who won a Nobel Prize, a Chicago economist who also is an anti-tax fellow. And his position was that if you lower taxes, that will, quote, starve the beast being the federal government or the state and local government. That will starve the beast, and they won't be able to pay for services or goods that they provide to their citizens. And therefore, spending will go down. And his position was it was the only way for spending to go down. Now, Ronald Reagan, who comes into office in 1981 and really brings the anti-tax movement away from the fringes where it had been residing into the White House and into the center of American politics, where it has stayed for half a century, for a generation or more. Ronald Reagan believed both of these things, even though they're in conflict and can't both be true. But he often told the story about how when he was in Hollywood as a B-movie actor, they did three movies a year, and then they quit working because it didn't pay to have to produce a fourth movie, because the top tax rate was then 91%, which is what it was, even though very few people ever paid it. And so he believed that there was a great work disincentive, and so he drank the supply side myth of lowering tax rates will raise revenue. And he also believed that the only way to put the federal government on a budget, he always described it as if the federal government had the same constraints that you and I and other American families have, that we can't borrow unlimited sums of money. That, you know, you have to put the government on a budget and that will cut spending. You know, the short answer to that is that when Reagan entered the presidency, the federal debt was $900 billion, which had been accumulated over the entire history of the nation until 1981. And when he left office, the debt was $2.7 trillion. He tripled the debt, largely through tax cuts, although also through spending increases, notably in his case, defense spending is what he increased the most. And when he was asked whether he had any regrets on his presidency, he said, yes, the deficits. this is our regret now, I suppose, not his regret anymore. But you have these two myths, and they conflict, and they've both been proven false, and yet they are clung to as if they were the gospel, which is one of the reasons I entitled the chapter "The Gospel: The Prophets of the Supply Side Gospel."
Yeah, and you know, one of the things I thought was really surprising about some of this, and you've spoken a little bit about it. I just want to come back to it a little bit, but especially with Reagan's place, it wasn't just anti-tax. It started to become anti-government, and you mentioned it a little bit too, but anti-IRS. And there's this interesting aspect of that, which is that Reagan was, and others since, I don't want to put it all on poor Reagan, but he's both waving the American flag and deeply anti-government at the same time. And that seems to come together in what you were talking about a little bit as this anti-IRS movement. And this is particularly surprising to me because, and for our listeners who I'm sure know, the IRS does not create tax policy. They are just implementing the policies that are written by Congress. I mean, we learned this, you know, I think everybody knows about this from the jingle from the old TV. Do you remember this, when how a bill becomes a law? And, you know, it is the tax policy is written by Congress. Congress holds the purse strings. The IRS is just the way of implementing. So why did this happen? And what is the purpose? Why go after the IRS? What's this anti-government aspect to it? And what does it do? Why is it good politically to go against the IRS?
Well, I think there are two things that are at issue here in the question that you've asked, Megan. One is that the anti-government piece was a very important aspect of the anti-tax movement's success in the late 1970s and into the 1980s when Reagan assumed office. And the reason for that was that there had been a lot of serious government failures in the 1970s, not the least of which was the Vietnam War, but there was also Watergate, there was Richard Nixon's resignation, there was the stagflation, which I mentioned, the failure to do anything that would solve the economy. There were a number of other political, well-known politicians who had become convicted of corruption and so forth, or accused of corruption and so forth. So there was a sort of anti-government thing in the air, and it was also very much tied up with race and the courts and the efforts of the courts to move out of the Jim Crow era that the Supreme Court had faced when it attempted to desegregate schools. And so the California Supreme Court, for example, said that no longer could you have schools that had a huge amount of money because they were in rich districts where property taxes were enough to pay for all of the education that you could ever hope for. And it didn't matter what happened in the poor districts, but they said that under this California Constitution, that difference couldn't be more than a certain amount. Now, the same charge was made in the Supreme Court of the United States, and the federal government, in a close opinion, said the opposite, said there is no right to education and there is no right to equal education or a fair education, if you prefer. And it was also a time when affirmative action was in the forefront of people's minds. The Bakke case, which was an affirmative action case involving, again, a California resident who had applied to University of California Davis Medical School and had been denied admission, and the Supreme Court granted admission to him. And so there was a lot of concern about that. And the thought, I think, by a lot of Americans, which has continued over this half century, is that immigrants and African Americans in particular, but minorities, were cutting in line, that they were cutting in line. And the people who felt that way didn't want to pay for the benefits they were getting, but they also didn't want to pay for the government officials who were giving them the benefits. And they didn't want to pay for the people at the, you know, welfare office who were handing out checks, or however they thought about it. And so that was all part of the anti-government movement. And then the Christian evangelicals, as we've talked about it, really thought the IRS overstepped its mandate. And Reagan said that he was going to reverse the IRS on the decision that, to deny tax exemptions to segregated schools, which he tried his very best to do, but the Supreme Court didn't let him do that. And that created an anti-IRS element that was very vigorous, and it had to do with policy decisions by the IRS. But the other piece of this, which is very important where the IRS is concerned, is that the American people basically say that they'd rather have a root canal than be audited by the Internal Revenue Service. And I was audited by the Internal Revenue Service, and I agree with them. I would have much rather had a root canal at the time. I had a very difficult agent and ended up hiring an accountant, and it cost me a lot of money for them not to change the amount of taxes I owed. And so people have this fear of the IRS, and the Republican Party has actually made that a mantra. You may remember in the 90s, Steve Forbes ran for president on something he called a flat tax. And he said, the IRS will be RIP if I'm elected president. There would be no more IRS. And that's been a goal of the people who now propose replacing all of the taxes in the U.S. with a sales tax, a national sales tax, because then the states would somehow collect the money for the federal government and you get rid of the IRS. Frank Luntz, who is a very well-known wordsmith for the Republican Party and conducts these focus groups, you may have seen him on TV, says that you never lose votes attacking the IRS. And so when the Biden administration managed last in 2022 to get additional funding for the IRS in order for them to be able to deal with all the tax returns they're getting and the, you know, their photos of paper returns and in cafeterias on
the
tables.
Cafeteria.
And,
that's what I thought of the photograph of the cafeteria overflowing with boxes.
Overwhelmed with paper in an effort to get them to modernize their equipment. A number of Republicans, including people like Chuck Grassley, an Iowa senator who was the head of the Finance Committee, started telling people that the IRS was going to come into your house with an AK-47 and that they were all going to take their guns and come into the IRS. And one more example of this, which I do talk about in the book, is the effort to repeal the estate tax, in which the estate tax, which is the only tax on wealth in the United States, and even though George W. Bush did manage to get it repealed for a year, it has been really withered away by the subsequent events. The effort there was to put the tax collector, the IRS official, side by side with the undertaker at your parents' deathbed or something. And so it's pretty effective to be against the IRS. Nobody likes the IRS. It's one of those things. But even so, it's the anti-government piece of this that endures as much as the anti-IRS piece of it. And so there is this tension about, we want our health insurance, we want our Social Security, we want our borders to be protected, we want the national defense, we want to be involved, many of us do, in world affairs in an effort to keep the world safe for democracy, to use another phrase we may have learned in high school. But there are a lot of people who now disagree with that. And so this is another way in which this is split. But the Republican Party has been very effective at lumping together the anti-tax movement, the anti-government sentiment, the anti-affirmative action sentiment, and the anti-IRS sentiment. All of these sentiments have been made the anti-tax movement one of the most overlooked and important social and political movements of the last half century.
It's interesting. You talk a lot about this in the book, but the anti-tax movement has largely come from the right. And you talked about a little bit about how it came from the Republican side, maybe primarily or originally. But over the last decades, it really has become something where we see increased resistance to tax, particularly tax increases, but tax in general across the political spectrum, with both Democrats and Republicans vowing not to raise taxes and really avoiding the whole issue, partly surely because of this sort of political messaging where it's very unpopular. Now we've gotten to a place where they're vowing not to raise taxes for most, if not all Americans, even to pay for wars and emergencies and economic crises. In the book, you go through this in some depth, but maybe you can just give us an overview of how it got to the place where both parties have sort of embraced this message and are now just reluctant to use the tax as a mechanism to maintain the government.
This is a great question. So it started in the Reagan administration, when after Reagan's assassination, it became clear that his political power and his political popularity had risen to a level where the Democrats, who had vowed to stop his tax reductions in 1981, reversed their position and essentially embraced his tax cuts and actually got into a bidding war with the Republicans over tax cuts in an effort to fashion their own bill. And they learned the hard way, I will say, that you can't outbid the Republicans on tax cuts. But that was in the early 80s. This century, the Democrats, I guess one other thing I should say is that, remember, the Democrats controlled the House of Representatives until 1994. So from 1954 to 1994, the Democrats had the House of Representatives. They lost the Senate a few times in that period, but they didn't. The Republicans never held the House until the 1994 elections, when they ran effectively against Bill Clinton's tax increases. And so there were a number of electoral events, I won't go through them here, but I do in the book, where the Democrats learned the electoral power of the anti-tax movement, and that you could win elections running against taxes and against the government. And Newt Gingrich coming into the Speaker's office of the House of Representatives in 1995 was a very important moment in learning that lesson. It's like many lessons in Washington, sometimes these lessons get learned too well. George Bush came in, and then he got his tax reductions early in his term, with help from what were then some centrist Democrats. John Breaux, the senator from Louisiana, Democratic senator from Louisiana, was particularly important in moving Bush's tax cuts through. And they were enacted, it's worth just noting this, they were enacted before 9/11. They were enacted on Memorial Day weekend in 2001. And then we have 9/11. And we then start this war on terror, and George W. Bush refuses to pay for it. So instead of asking the American public to pay for this war, it's the first war in the history of America that was not paid for by either new taxes or increased taxes. And then in 2003, he asked for more tax cuts at the same time he was asking for a prescription drug benefit for Medicare, which again, just blew up the debt and the deficits. In the 2008 campaign for the Democratic nomination for president, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton agreed in a debate in Philadelphia when George Stephanopoulos asked them about taxes that they would not increase taxes on anybody with less than $250,000 of income. That was 2008. In 2013, when Barack Obama could have ended all of the Bush tax cuts and started afresh and had been reelected president, had no opportunity to run for office again, for reasons that I do not understand, he decided to extend all of the tax cuts for everybody with less than $400,000 of income. It was a deal that was negotiated by Joe Biden, his vice president, and Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader of the Senate. Why Obama agreed to it is a mystery to me. I do not understand it, but he did. And that's where Joe Biden got his $400,000 number. And he now says he'll not increase his taxes on anyone with less than $400,000, except for some large corporations. And that's where the Democratic Party is today. And so the Republican Party won't increase taxes on anyone. They've signed pledges. We haven't talked about Grover Norquist and his pledges, but they've signed pledges never to increase taxes. And the Democrats basically have now pledged not to increase taxes on 98% of the American people. So they're only going to tax the rich somehow. And this is how successful the movement has become. That is, having started off as sort of a fringe movement with fringe economists and Howard Jarvis, who could not have been more than a fringe player in Republican politics in California, to the mainstream, to the point where both parties are now anti-tax in a fundamental way, which means that we have to borrow to pay for our government.
I am tempted to go down the rabbit hole of these amazing characters, Norquist and Jarvis, but I am going to recommend to our listeners that they read the book because it is worth it. These are real characters with like tremendous stories, and were able to be way out of their league in terms of impact on the nation. But I'm going to resist the urge to go down that rabbit hole for today because I don't have you for that long. And I really want to spend some time on some of the implications of what this has done to the economy and why it's such a big deal. So I want to take us back to the debt and the debt ceiling and what it has done. Because if I understand it, you know, correctly after reading all this, we got to a place where because we couldn't really implement tax increases or use the tax to raise funds for what we want to do, we had to get it someplace else. And the place we got it, as you mentioned, is really to go for debt. And where at some points, maybe that debt would have been mostly American debt, now we have a bunch of American debt and a bunch of foreign debt. So we've really gotten into this very different place as a nation. And we then created when I say we, you can maybe talk about this if you want, but we implemented a debt ceiling. So now we have these regular panics about the government and how are we going to even keep going? we now have these built-in sort of shutdown dramas related to debt and debt crises. I just feel like there's so much about this. So I want to go there. Maybe you can describe a little bit about what happened and how do you think this cycle works? And maybe if you have ideas how we might get out of it, that would be awesome.
Well, let me start with the debt ceiling. So the U.S. is the only country in the world, I think. There may be one other, but it may be somebody like Estonia that has a debt ceiling, which says that you can only issue a certain amount of debt unless Congress and the president, unless it's authorized by Congress. Other countries can issue debt, and there's no legal limitation on the issuance of debt. And the Republican Party discovered this century, that when a Democrat was in the White House in particular, that it could hold the country hostage by saying, we're not going to raise the debt ceiling, and therefore we can't pay the bills and we can't pay the debt that we owe, debt which has been accumulated, obviously, by Congresses previous to the Congress that's now being asked to raise the ceiling and over a number of years. It's a very bad law, and the use of it as a hostage-taking event, which is what it's become, and was most recently in 2023. We saw this in 2023. This is a horrible situation, because it's one of those things that you assume it's going to get settled, and that you've taken the hostage, but you've taken the hostage not because you want the hostage, but because you want something else. And there's always something else. I mean, it was 20% of the IRS funding that got cut as the debt ceiling hostage this time. It has happened only so far when we've had a Democrat in the White House and a Republican majority in one of the houses of Congress, almost always in the House of Representatives. Newt Gingrich used this first, I think, as a vehicle of this sort, but it's been used since. And it's very dangerous. And the rating agencies who have treated U.S. debt as if it's the actually riskless asset in the world, the one asset you can count on, have lowered the federal debt rating twice now because of the debt ceiling being held hostage during the Obama administration and now during the Biden administration. The Democrats, when they were in Congress, did not do this when it had to be increased during the Trump administration, and it had to be increased a lot during the Trump administration. But this has become a purely Republican ploy. I mean, since I am critical of both the Democrats and the Republicans on the anti-tax issue, I want to be clear that this is the debt ceiling is a Republican issue, and it's folly. It's absolutely unthinkable that the U.S. would default on its debt, but they keep pushing us toward a default, and it's just hard to fathom. That's the debt ceiling piece. Go ahead, Megan.
I want to just ask one other question about that, because I think there is a certain portion of the population, and I would not be able to characterize what portion it is, who don't think it's such a big deal, who sort of see, and I think maybe there's something about the Republican Party where their supporters maybe have some idea that it's okay to go up to the brink and, threaten. And then the question is, would it really be so bad that they would allow the failure on the debt? And I think when I hear about this, and of course I read the news and get upset, but I think there is some question about why it's so bad. Everyone says it would be a catastrophe, but I think that the real danger, is bigger than the sort of like, oh, it breaks the norm, or, oh, you didn't pay your bill that month. Like, it really is a major national issue, but you don't see in the news that people talk too much about why that would be such a catastrophe.
I think the fact that it's such a catastrophe is a reason people believe it won't ever happen, that they'll really hold the hostage and let the U.S. government hit the ceiling without paying its bills. And so if you hit the debt ceiling and you can't issue any more debt, and the government is constantly issuing debt because debt comes due and it's reissued, and then there's new debt that we're accumulating all the time because our taxes are not paying for our government, and they haven't for a very long time. They haven't since the year 2001. So the big problem is, what do you not pay? Do you not pay off the debt that you've accumulated and that you've promised to pay? Or do you not pay off the Social Security bills that are due and instead pay off the debt? So the Treasury Department, the president, would be confronted with a problem, and the problem would be you either default on the debt, which would make the great financial crisis and the recession that we experienced in 2007 to 2009 look like a walk in the park, because it would roil financial markets all over the world, because A, it calls the dollar into question and the value of the dollar, and you have dollar denominated transactions that just go on outside of the U.S. all the time, the most obvious being oil and gas, which are purchased in dollar denominated. You know, Saudi Arabia sells its oil in dollars, not in some other currency. So we have the reserve currency of the world, and it'll throw that into question. And then the question is, if you're not going to pay your debts, then what are you not going to do? Are you not going to pay army bill, you know, wages? Are you not going to pay federal government wages? Are you going to stop Social Security checks? Are you not going to pay the hospitals that have incurred Medicare bills? You know, if there's a legal constraint, and you have to do something. Now, there is this myth that keeps surfacing every time the debt ceiling is reached, that you can just mint a $1 trillion coin and you'll have enough money to do it. And there's the $1 trillion coin nonsense. And that's, you know, so that's not going to happen. So there are these myths that you can get around it in some fashion, but I don't think you can get around it. And I think it's more and more dangerous. And I think we get closer and closer because of where the Republican Party has gone, frankly, in terms of its views of government. Every time it's held hostage, there's a real risk of default, and it's going to be a very bad situation if we get there. And the debt ceiling is due to expire in March of 2025. So you and I are talking about something that's right around the corner from the next election. It will not be an election issue because you can't explain it to the American public. But it should be an American. It should be an election issue.
I think one other thing. Oh, go ahead.
All right, go ahead. You go right ahead.
No, I was just going to say that I believe that part of the reason that it is so scary is because it dovetails with the anti-government aspect of the anti-tax movement. Meaning, people have this very hot rhetoric about being anti-tax and being anti-IRS and, by extension, being anti-government. We talked a little bit about how Reagan did that, but it has continued and gotten more since then. And so I think for some portion of the political groups, it's like, well, yeah, you know, we want to take it down. And this is a way that we could actually take it down, take the government down. I think maybe they don't realize they actually take the whole country down, not just, you know, the government.
Yeah, I think that was a lesson that we failed to learn during the financial crisis, when the Federal Reserve basically kept the world economy on track in some fashion. And we had a huge recession. There were a lot of people unemployed, and it could have been a lot worse. And this would, I think, be a lot worse. But it's foolhardy. I mean, it's really foolishness that we're having this conversation. But it's reality. It's not myth.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that you've asked about, which is the debt itself and the amount of debt that we've accumulated, is really worth mentioning. And so we now have a federal debt that's over $34 trillion. It's larger than the GDP of the United States in any given year. It's more than 100% of GDP. Interest on the federal debt for 2024 is going to be 3.1% of GDP. It's about $870 billion. It's a lot of money, and it's a larger number than the economic growth of the United States. So we're spending more in interest than we're growing. So all of our growth is being devoted to interest on the debt. The last time we had this much debt relative to the size of the economy was at the end of World War II. And at that time, the U.S. had all the money there was. That is to say that Europe was a shambles, and Japan was a shambles, and China was entering into a dark communist era, and Russia was only interested in arming itself and hegemony in the Eastern European nations and competing with the U.S. elsewhere. And we were poised to grow. The American economy was poised to grow at 6% or so in a way that was broadly shared among the American public. And 95% of the debt was owed to the American people. Now, 30 to 35 cents of every dollar we're paying in interest is just going abroad. And so we're just shipping money abroad in interest payments that we have to pay for in some way. And we keep issuing more debt to pay for the interest that we're paying on the federal debt. And then the other 65 to 70 cents is paid to Americans who hold the debt. The CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, projects that if we continue along any kind of path that they can foresee, that this is going to continue for a long time, and that by 2050, we'll be paying interest that's 7 to 8% of the size of the GDP. Well, you know, if we're spending that much money on interest, how are we going to spend money on all the things that we need? And interest is the fastest growing expenditure in the federal government at the moment. And it's more this year than Medicare or national defense. The only thing that is greater is Social Security. And so I think this is a real problem. Now, Herb Stein, who was a well-known economist and was Gerald Ford's chief economic advisor, testified about the deficits in the mid-80s, and he created something that became known as Stein's Law. And what he said was that if something cannot go on, it will stop. And that's Stein's Law. And so the question is, how will it stop? And this is a very difficult question. And as you know, I don't end the book with an answer to this question. If you look at the recent estimates of federal spending over the next several years, they're never less than 21 or 22% under the most optimistic assumptions. That's where they were with Ronald Reagan. You know, when he left office, it was 20.8% of GDP is what we were spending. We've got an aging population, which needs more health care and more retirement benefits. We've got a smaller workforce. We're not prepared to expand the workforce through legal immigration to the extent that we should if we wanted to operate in a sensible way, to have a ratio of workers to retirees and children that makes sense. And so it's very hard to believe that the economy is going to have some huge burst of productivity like it did in the late 1990s when we went to the information economy that we had. Some people hold out hope for that with artificial intelligence. And so I'm going to hold out hope for that with artificial intelligence, although I will say that I'm a little worried, not by the word intelligence, but by the word artificial. And I think that it has a double meaning, and it may turn out to be a myth along with some other, not artificial intelligence will be a myth, but that it will solve our debt problems. I think there is no solution other than raising taxes and putting some limits on spending. And that's going to be very hard to do. And it turns out that neither the Republican Party nor the Democratic Party want to do it. And Donald Trump basically put an end to the Republican Party's endless statements that they were going to cut Medicare and cut Social Security, and this was how they were going to cut spending, and they were going to privatize Social Security, which Ronald Reagan favored and George W. Bush tried and didn't happen. And that seems to have gone by the wayside. So we're going to have more taxes somewhere. I have in other books argued that the U.S. needs a broad-based tax on sales of goods and services, like there are in 175 other countries in the world. I once challenged a student to name 175 countries, and she did, which means that I will no longer challenge anyone to do that. But I think there are only 190 countries in the world. So I was impressed that anybody could do it. But it means that the U.S. is really the only country in the developed world that does not have a national tax on sales of goods and services, and everybody else has one. I think we're going to have to go there, but, you know, so far nobody wants to go there. And that's a tax that would apply to people below $400,000 of income. And you think about it, we can't have a carbon tax because that would apply to people below $400,000 of income. And we couldn't even have a sensible alcohol tax or tobacco tax these days if we stick to the promises of both parties. And so I don't see an easy road out. And I think we're going to continue along this path until we hit a crisis. Now, the one thing about the debt ceiling is that it could produce a crisis immediately, and that would then require people to become serious again in some fashion. But there's a lot of unseriousness in American politics today, and I think we're at a point where we're going to have to become serious again, but I'm not sure exactly when that's going to happen or how.
So I'm going to hold out my hope that we can move beyond the fantasy era and the gospel area about this and start to have some real discussions about what are our options on the table and hopefully not get to a huge crisis before we start to actually put them on the table. But you know, I am an optimist, and I want to hold on to my optimism as long as I can. But I found that the book was really helpful to understand some really complex issues. Also very entertaining. I know that's not the point, but it really is like a rollicking read, taking through a lot of stuff that was happening that even the stuff I was, you know, there for. I really learned a lot about who the characters were and what the pressures were and what some of the considerations beyond what like a normal taxpayer, you know, might be thinking about. So I am aware of time. So I want to close us out. I want to ask you two last things. The penultimate one is I'd like you to just tell our listeners what is the sort of most important thing that you want them to take away from this book?
Well, that's a very good question. I think the most important thing is that taxes and tax policy decisions are about who we are as a country and who we want to be as a country. And do we want to be a country that basically says we're going to keep putting off these issues through borrowing? Or do we want to be a country that says, no, we're going to step up and we're going to pay for what we want from our governments, and we're going to be serious and realistic about that? And so I think that is the big takeaway from what I've written. I should also say that I'm an optimist as well. I've always been an optimist. This book is clearly my most pessimistic exercise in writing. But I am optimistic that will happen. I just don't know how it happens in the absence of a crisis. And I really worry about the next, having lived recently through the financial crisis and COVID, I really don't think we should head ourselves into another crisis that we could avoid if we just became more serious about it. So I guess that's the takeaway that I would leave your listeners with.
Well, I appreciate that. And now I'd like to ask you, I always ask for a book recommendation that you have for our listeners.
So I actually thought about this, and I hadn't thought about it in response to your previous questions about the debt ceiling. But I was thinking about what was the book that I had really enjoyed reading once I stopped reading about economics and politics and government. I read hundreds of books, I guess, for this, or parts of hundreds of books of this. I could tell you the worst book I read in this process, but I will not do that.
Two goods is better than one bad.
I'll give you a good one. So I did read recently, I had missed it when it came out, Anthony Doerr's Cloud Cuckoo Land, which I really loved. I didn't love it because it was about cuckoo land, which is what we've been talking about to some extent, but I loved it because it was about books and libraries and words. And he had written previously, as you know, All the Light We Cannot See, which I thought was one of the great novels I'd read of the last 25 years or so. And I just missed this book completely, but one of my daughters was reading it on a trip we took to the Caribbean in December. And she handed it to me and I read it and I really thoroughly enjoyed it. It's very different than any book he's written before. And I thought it was great, but it's surprising to me that here we are talking about Cuckoo Land after talking about the anti-tax movement. There seems to be a certain way in which you've managed to bring things together that I had never occurred to me.
But it's now, all about Cuckoo Land.
Now it's all about Cuckoo Land. It's the prophets of Cuckoo Land.
Well, thank you so much. I think we'll leave it there for now. Michael Gratz, it has been such a pleasure discussing your book, The Power to Destroy, How the Anti-Tax Movement Hijacked America. Thank you for joining us on the New Books Network.
And thank you, Megan, for having me. It's been a great pleasure.